Hi, my name's John Stewart, and I'm here to tell you about DOS, the disk operating system for IBM and compatible computers. Several years ago, I was right where you are now. I had an IBM-compatible computer, a few programs, and a lot of questions. The stores were full of books, some of them very expensive, and all of them thick, and I had no idea where to begin. Fortunately, I had some friends to help me with the basics and set me up with some clear instructions about this mysterious-sounding DOS. Once I had the fundamentals down, the rest came easily. Now it's my turn to help you, regardless of what type or brand of IBM or compatible you own. I'll be telling you how to start up your computer safely, how to tell what's on your disks, how to copy from one disk to another, and a lot more. At the end of this tape, I included a special section for those of you with a built-in hard drive. I kept that part separate to keep things simple. Simplicity is the rule throughout this tape. I'm sure you'll find this an easy and inexpensive way to master the basics of operating your computer. And with all the money you'll save avoiding those thick how-to books, you can go out and buy some more programs. The first thing I'll simplify is the question of what DOS type you're using. Some computers come with MS-DOS, others have variations which work the same way. This guide to common DOS commands will work with all types using commands found in the majority of older and newer DOS production releases. That's why there's a number at the end of your DOS disk. The higher the number, the newer the version. I'm going to tell you how to use DOS in everyday situations without a lot of double talk and without a lot of tech speak. There are a lot of reasons why you want to know about DOS. Maybe you just purchased an IBM or compatible computer, and the manual that came with it would put an insomniac to sleep. Maybe they plopped a PC on your work desk and said, "Here, learn how to use this." Or maybe you've learned how to run your word processor, but when it comes to preparing a disk to make copies or to format something or erase something, you keep going down the hall and asking Fred over there for help. Regardless, I'm going to go step by step through the most basic functions of what is known as the disk operating system to give you an overview of how things work. This should enable you to turn on your machine, examine what's on the disks, and get some work done. I'm also going to assume that you know little or nothing about your IBM or compatible computer. This way, nobody gets lost in the crowd, and if I'm hitting a part that you know, you can hit the fast-forward button, and then we'll catch up with you. In the broadest sense, a computer consists of two major parts, the hardware, which is the metal box, the keyboard, the monitor, things like that, and the software, which is the material contained on the disks that you use with your machine. A good analogy for this, and one that everybody listening is familiar with, is your cassette recorder. The player itself is kind of like the hardware, and the cassette itself, with my voice on it, is somewhat like the computer's software. By itself, that cassette player doesn't do very much. And of course, by itself, the cassette sitting there, maybe on your car seat, doesn't do much either. But you put the two of them together, and the player uses the tape to find out what music or voice to reproduce. It's the same idea with software on a disk. That disk feeds information to the computer that makes the computer put certain things on the screen, make noises, start up other disks, and various other functions. The main primary piece of software that you're going to be dealing with every time you turn on your machine is the disk operating system. The disk operating system is known by most folks as the DOS, DOS system, the DOS disk. The DOS disk is not just one program. It's a collection of programs that makes your computer perform a number of tasks. One of the first questions you're going to be asked when you mention you're learning about DOS is, what version do you have? Well, don't worry about that right now. There are versions or editions of DOS, depending on how old they are, from DOS 1 to DOS 2, 2.1, 3, 3.3, and now at least DOS 4 version. The higher the number, the newer and more improved, they hope, it is. You'll find that the basic bread-and-butter functions of DOS that allow you to copy and delete files, the things that I'll be telling you about, are found in virtually every version that you may be using. Your machine has either one or two disk drives. These are called floppy drives, which refer to the removable disks that slide into the slots in the front of the machine. Nowadays, disks come in two sizes, the larger 5¼-inch original floppy disk, or the smaller and more rigid 3½-inch diskette. Either one can contain the disk operating system. Also, for convenience, a lot of computers have what they call a built-in hard drive, or hard disk, which is a permanently installed large disk that can hold the equivalent of 30, 60, or more floppies worth of information. If you have a hard disk, chances are that the disk operating system, the DOS, has been transferred onto that hard drive. Regardless of whether you're working with a floppy, a 3.5-inch diskette, or a hard drive, DOS works the same way. Frequently, you'll hear the DOS disk referred to as a boot disk. Now, that's an old computer term. Booting a system simply means starting it up. You need a DOS disk to start most computers. If you try putting in a blank disk or some other disk, you normally get a kind of warning on the screen that says, "Hey, that's not what I'm looking for." The normal message is non-system disk or disk error. That's because as your computer starts up, it looks for the DOS to tell it a number of things about itself, what it needs to get operating. Okay, let's take a look at the DOS disk so we can see what is on it. First, before you do anything else, make sure you're working with a copy of your original DOS disk. The original should have a nice printed label and all that. A copy would probably be handwritten or typed on, but if you're using the original, please stop now and have someone help make you a copy. I don't want to talk you through the copying process right now, as there are too many different machines with different drives out there. Later we'll learn to do this, but for now, get or use a working copy of DOS. The reason's very simple. Even expert computer users make mistakes. And if you accidentally wreck your DOS disk and you have no other, there is no way you'll be able to get anything done until you get a replacement. Let's talk about starting up the machine the safe way. If you have a machine with no built-in hard drive, just do the following. With no disks in the machine, turn it on. You'll see a few messages, maybe some numbers counting, other self-tests depending on the machine. But in a few seconds, you'll get that non-system disk or disk error message on your screen. That's absolutely normal. Now, put in your DOS disk in your first drive, frequently called drive A, then close the latch and press any key. The computer will then discover the DOS disk when it checks drive A and begins the booting procedure. I can hear you saying right now, "John, wait a minute now. If the computer looks for the DOS disk in drive A when it's turned on, and when it doesn't find the DOS disk in drive A, it gives you an error message telling you to put it in and press any key, why not just put the DOS disk in at the very beginning before you turn on the computer?" That's a good question. The truth is, a lot of folks do it just that way. However, in the strictest technical sense, it's not a good idea. Here's why. When the computer turns on, there are all kinds of electrical pulses going through it. There is stuff going everywhere inside that machine. And it's possible that a small power surge could get into the disk drive itself and put a little tiny magnetic blip on that disk that's sitting there before the machine even realizes what's going on. Little magnetic blips to disks are like spilling grease on a necktie. They tend to ruin them. So if you have a disk in place in your computer when you turn it on or when you turn it off, you run this risk. Now, this has hardly ever happened to me, but it does and it can happen. Since the quality of the components being used in computers nowadays varies from superbly engineered and tested to bargain basement, there's really no way for me to tell how well your machine will treat disks at turn-on time. If you have a DOS disk that is one of many backup copies that you own, and there's absolutely nothing else on that disk that is unique or special, okay, then you can put the disk in, turn it on, and take your chances. And for those of you who are using a hard disk system, using a DOS disk in drive A is the only way you're going to completely ignore the hard drive for the purpose of learning with this tape. The computer will find the DOS on drive A and go no further. However, for those of you with a hard drive, there's an even safer way of doing it than just putting the DOS disk in and turning the machine on. It's called a warm boot. Let's say you've turned on your machine, the one that has the hard drive built in, and it looks for the DOS disk in drive A, and not finding it there, it goes to drive C, the built-in hard drive, and it finds it. Okay, most hard drives are set up with some kind of automatic menu program that will then appear on the screen. You ignore all that. Once your hard disk is up and running and the stuff's on the screen, you place your DOS disk in drive A, and then you hold down the keys marked Control, usually CTRL, Alt, ALT, and Delete, DEL. Hold those down at the same time. This will cycle the computer back through its opening procedure without turning off the power. Then it'll look for DOS, and this time we'll find it on Drive A, and you're exactly where the folks are with no hard drive. But a final word of warning, regardless of whether you have a hard drive or not, never leave any important disks in the machine as you turn it on and off. The only disk that is protected against this is your built-in hard drive, if you have one. All others are subject to something called data corruption, and you don't want to deal with it. Okay, by whatever method you've selected, you're booting up your computer with the DOS disk in Drive A. It takes a few seconds as the machine sorts itself out, and up on your screen, one of the first things you'll see is the current date is, usually followed by either nothing, or the date you're really living in, or some strange date from a long time ago. Then it says, enter new date with the MM month, DD day, YY year format. If your machine has something called a built-in clock and calendar, usually an optional extra when you bought it, chances are that the date on the screen will be accurate. In that case, just hit your Enter key to confirm. If the date is not correct, you can then type in the correct date and hit Enter. And if you don't really care, just hit Enter and the computer will accept whatever date it was displaying. The same is true of the next time statement that comes up. You will notice that your computer uses a 24-hour clock or military time as opposed to AM and PM. So 1 p.m. is 1300, 2 p.m. is 1400, 11:30 p.m. is 2330, and so on. Again, accept the time as given, correct it, or just hit Enter if you don't care. Not correctly setting the date and time may come back to haunt you someday when you're looking for a forgotten file by date, or maybe you typed a note without a date and you need to get some idea of when you wrote it. So you might want to go ahead and enter the date and time accurately. Having entered the date and time, the next thing you're going to see is a notice telling you whose DOS you're using and other copyright information. The most important thing on the screen at this point is in the lower left-hand corner. It's called the A prompt, the letter A with that greater than arrow-like symbol next to it. This means the computer is properly started, you are logged on to Disk Drive A, and the computer is asking, hey, what's next? Let's take a closer look at this, as there are several things you're being told, even with the small amount of information on the screen. The A indicates you are logged on to A. Great, what does that mean? It means that if you type a command in, the computer will look for the program and try to do what you tell it to do with the disk drive A. It's kind of like a You Are Here sign at the mall. In most cases, you'll always be logged on to Drive A, which is your first drive. If you have a second drive, it should be B. And if you have a built-in hard drive, that one should be C. But please note that if you have only one drive, A, and you have a hard drive, the hard drive is still called C, even if you have no B at this time. This is an industry standard to avoid confusion for several reasons that we will discover later. But right now, it's A for the first drive, B for the second, whether you have one or not, and C for the built-in hard drive. It's important to keep track of which drive you're logged onto, or you may end up erasing files that you need or simply getting back a lot of error statements from your computer when it can't find what you're looking for. You are here. Drive A. Look for it. After the A and the arrow, you'll see a little blinking line. That means everything is working great. The mark there, the blinking line or cursor in computer terms, only disappears or stops blinking when the computer gets into trouble. So normally, at that point, you'd have to turn off the machine and start again if you lose your cursor. That's C-U-R-S-O-R, not what you do if that blinking line goes away. Also, please take note that whenever I refer to drive A or drive B or drive C, always put a colon after that A, B, or C when you're typing in on your keyboard. This way, the computer knows you're talking about a disk drive A as opposed to the letter you've written called A. Just remember, whenever you type a disk drive designation A, B, or C, always put a colon after it. Right now, the cursor is sitting there blinking at us, waiting to go ahead. And the first thing we'll do is look at the contents of your DOS disk. We'll call up a directory. To do this, type in DIR and hit Enter. If you're typing along with me right now, you'll see most of the directory contents scroll rapidly up the screen, just like fast-forwarding a movie on a VCR. Let's make it a bit easier by typing DIR, but adding a slash and the letter P. Now you're telling the computer to scroll only as far as one screenful and pause, hence the letter P, until you hit any key to go to the next screenful. Try it if you're at a keyboard. Type DIR slash P and hit enter. You're getting all the directory information available, including the name of the file, the type of the file, the size of the file, even the date and time when it was last saved on the disk. That's why I say you might want to do that accurately when you start your computer. If you don't need to see all that size and information and the date at one time, there's an easy way to see just the names of the files. You type in DIR slash W as opposed to just DIR and hit enter. DIR slash W and hit enter. This presents an abbreviated directory of the disk spread out in wide columns across the screen. Just remember, the W in DIR slash W means wide. Let's type in DIR slash W and look at the contents of the DOS disk more closely. You'll notice that the names of the files on the disk have two parts. The first is the name of the file itself and is never more than 8 letters. It is followed by a space and then a 3-letter extension. These 3 letters tell you what kind of file it is. Files that end in .exe or .com are actually programs that will do something if you type in their names. And by the way, you don't have to type in the extension, the 3-letter abbreviation I just talked about, just the name of the program. For example, on your DOS disk, you'll see a utility program like disk copy or format. They have endings .com or .exe. When you go to use those utility programs on your DOS disk, you simply type in the first part. That's their name. The same is true of most commercial software. If you happen to own a word processor, you might discover that its file name is Writer.com, Writer.com. In order to run that program, you'd simply type the word Writer at the cursor. Many of the programs on your DOS disk with the .com or .exe endings are utility programs. These are programs that do something to change the way the computer works, to copy files, to help sort out information. DOS is not one big program, but it's a series of smaller ones that do a great deal of the computer's housekeeping and work behind the scenes. Keep this in mind because it helps take away some of the mystery and confusion as to what DOS does. Let's look at that directory again. You'll notice the file there called command.com, command.com. Command.com is the one program that cannot be removed from a DOS disk and still have it work. Command.com is automatically loaded into your computer's memory every time you boot up. It's the main source for some of the basic functions of your computer's operation and many of the commands you'll learn about on this tape. Remember, you never have to type in command.com to use it, because unlike other parts of your DOS disk, it's already loading as you boot your computer up. Command.com is what lets you do things like type in DIR slash W to see the directory. For the time being, please don't type in any of the .com or .exe file names to see what they do. Some are powerful commands that can even erase your disk. Other extensions include files with the ending .sys or .sys. These are files of information that are used by the computer's system to know what it's hooked up to. An important file is one called config.sys, which holds the configuration of your computer so that it knows what kind of monitor you have, what language you're using so the keyboard will match, what memory is available, and things like that. Someday you may even try to run a friend's program and get the message bad or missing config.sys. That means that the computer setup you have is not what the program on that particular disk is looking for. Some other files that you'll be creating will have the extension endings like doc, doc for document, or txt for text. Many databases store their information in files with the extensions dbf for database file. Usually, the program you're using, maybe a spreadsheet, a writing program, or a database, will automatically tack on the appropriate extension when you save the file to disk. So you'd normally type in your file name, like finances, and the computer would do the rest. But it's good to know these extensions because once in a while you're going to want to find a particular file without having to start up your word processor or whatever program you're using. By now, you should have a better idea of what a DOS disk is. It makes the computer start up and run properly, and contains a set of utilities that allows you to take care of day-to-day chores when you use the machine. One of them is the ability to let you see what's on the disk drive you're using. Next, I'm going to tell you about formatting disks and using some DOS utilities. Before you can do much else, you need to have some disks that you can work with, some disks that you can save programs and files to. Unfortunately, you can't just take a brand new disk out of the package, pop it in the computer, and save information to it. These computer disks are simply magnetized round plastic sheets inside a sort of envelope with absolutely nothing else on them. The reason they're blank is because of the various types of computers. There's IBM, there's Apple, Commodore, and each of them sets up a blank disk according to its own needs. It's called formatting. And simply put, it means laying down some magnetic tracks for the computer to use, very much like a third grader penciling in lines on a piece of blank paper with a ruler before the writing begins. The problem is that each type of computer lays down those tracks in a different way, so that a formatted disk on, say, a Commodore will not work on an IBM, and an Apple disk will not work on a Commodore, and so on. That's why the disk manufacturers leave them blank, and you have to do what is known as formatting a disk for your IBM or compatible computer. Within the IBM and compatible computer community, there are also several different types of disks. You may have the 5 1/4-inch floppy disk or the smaller and more rigid 3 1/2-inch disk. This can cause some confusion because there are different types of disks also in each size as well. It's really not complicated, but let's go through this so you'll know what's going on. This is because in the 10 years or so that IBM compatibles have been around, the amount of material that can be stored on an individual disk has been increasing. And in most cases, the newer the computer, the more data the disk can store. Because of this change, we run into something called upward or downward compatibility problems. This means that if you have an older machine that holds 360K of data per 5 1/4-inch disk, the newer machine can read that information from your disk. But if the newer machine saves a file on its own high-capacity disk that looks almost identical to yours, you won't be able to read that file on your older PC. The same is true of the smaller plastic 3 1/2-inch size disks. A lot of computers, especially laptops that are about 3 years old or more, use a disk that holds 720K of data. The newer machines use a disk of the same physical size, but it holds twice as much. And these higher capacity disks also have a special hole or notch in them to prevent the user of an older machine from even working with them. I mention this to you now because a lot of you are going to have a machine at home that's a little bit older than your computer at work. Find out what size and capacity disk is used at work before you take home some big project for the weekend and discover you can't use the disk on your machine at home. When it comes to buying commercial software, it's much, much easier. Most products come in the so-called older 360K large disk or the older 720K smaller size disk. This way, nobody gets left out in the cold because all machines are downwardly compatible. I'd like to be able to reach out of the cassette right now and tell you which size disk you have, but you're going to have to check with your manual or your sales clerk or a friend or coworker to see what kind of disks you're using. Check that out, get a few blank disks, and then we're going to learn how to format them. Okay, I'm going to assume now that you know what type of disk you need for your machine. You've got the computer up and running with the DOS disk in drive A, and you can tell that because of the prompt on your screen. It shows an A, right? Okay, now let's type dir/w to view the directory, the contents of the disk, one more time. And there, lurking among the various COM and EXE files, is the program, the utility called format. The formatting utility on your DOS disk is the program that you use to lay down the magnetic tracks on your blank disk. The format utility is one of the most dangerous programs on your disk. Why is it dangerous? Well, when you format a disk, your disk drive lays down those magnetic tracks. And should you have accidentally put in a disk that had important information on it, it's history. I doubt if even the CIA has any kind of technique for retrieving information once a disk has been formatted. It's just like accidentally recording over your favorite video cassette. The old stuff is gone, you just can't get it back. So you have to be extremely careful and listen to what I have to say and double-check what you're doing when you go to format a disk. If something doesn't seem right as we go along, you stop until you're sure that everything is the way it's supposed to be. With your DOS disk in drive A and a blank disk nearby, type the words format space A colon and hit enter. Keep in mind there is still time to back out. By typing the word format at that A prompt, you're telling the computer to load the formatting program into the machine, that's all. A couple of seconds will go by as the machine loads the program into memory, and now it says insert a blank disk in drive A and hit enter. Now is the time to remove the DOS disk and replace it with the blank one before you press enter. Be careful here because the computer doesn't know if you've changed disks. If you leave the DOS disk in drive A and press enter, the format program will go merrily on its way and destroy your DOS disk, leaving only nice empty space in its wake. So, with the DOS disk out, the blank disk in, press enter. As the format program works, you may see some numbers flashing by, some information about which sector is being formatted, things like that. It's mildly interesting to watch, at least the first time. The formatting process will take what seems like a long time, or longer, depending on the capacity of your disk. You'll see it's being checked and verified as the tracks are laid down, kind of a quality control process. At the end, there'll be a display that tells you the format is complete, what size disk has been formatted, then it asks you if you wish to format another with a Y or N for yes or no. When you hit N, it returns to the comfort of the A prompt, but before you do that, let's check that display again for a listing of bad sectors. You see, sometimes after showing the capacity of the formatted disk, you'll also see a display showing the number of something called bad sectors. This means that a portion of your disk was not deemed suitable for use by the quality control check, and it's been magnetically marked off limits to the disk drive. Your disk is still usable, but it will not hold quite as much as it would have if all sectors were good. Sometimes these defects are so slight that a second formatting of the disk puts them back into commission. Again, it's fairly rare to find bad sectors with today's good quality disks. If you do get a disk with bad sectors, do try to reformat it before you do anything else. That frequently makes it right. Where the program says format another disk, just type in yes as opposed to no, and then hit return, leaving the same disk in place. The computer, once again, will format that disk. You haven't got to put the DOS back in the machine because that format program you loaded is still in the computer memory and the whole process just starts over again. If at the end of this, the disk still has these defects, these bad sectors, if you get those, I would suggest throwing the disk away. Here's why. There's always the slightest chance that your disk is a lemon, that the magnetic coating is flaking off, kind of like a bad paint job on a car. The good sectors on the disk may turn into bad sectors sometime later after you've stored some important information on them. It's just not worth the risk in terms of money or time. When you've finished with the format program, type an N or no to tell the computer you don't wish to format another disk, and then you're back at the A prompt. The format program is now removed from the computer memory, and you're ready to do something else. I'll tell you how to copy files to these formatted disks in just a few seconds, but as long as we're talking about bad sectors, let's spend a moment to talk about disk buying and economy. Disks are cheap nowadays, even the most expensive ones, the high-capacity versions. They're really coming down in price. If you find a brand you like, just stick with it. An off-brand computer disk, or maybe even a computer disk with no brand name whatsoever, may be the best bargain in the world for you. On the other hand, it might be second rate. You're going to be storing your hard work on these disks, so think about the risk and you make your own decision. With a supply of quality formatted disks, you'll never get stuck if it's 10 o'clock at night and you need some empty disks to save your work. Another use for blank formatted disks is to have extra copies of important files in case something happens to your first disk. There are several ways to make backup copies of important files. One way is to save the document or spreadsheet or whatever from your program twice. Simply repeat whatever procedure your program requires with two different disks. When you save a file to a disk, you're copying the file in the computer's memory onto the disk for permanent storage. Another way to make copies of files without using your favorite word processor or whatever is by using the DOS command copy. Even though copy is a DOS command, don't go looking for it as a file on your DOS disk, as it won't be there. The copy command is part of the command.com file and is what is known in computer terms as an internal command. It is one of a handful of commands which are loaded into your computer's memory when you boot up. It's always available. Chances are you've made cassette copies of records or CDs. The DOS copy command does the same thing, but it makes an identical dub of whatever file you want from one disk to another. The command to copy is one of the commands always at your disposal, regardless of what disk you're logged onto. Copying is simple, but unlike the format command, you have to give the computer a bit more information. You have to tell it the name of the file you want to copy and where you want it to go. Let's say you've got a letter called Vacation Doc on your disk. If you have two disk drives, put in your blank, formatted disk in the second drive, that's drive B, and your original in drive A. You do not need the DOS disk in any drive at this time, as the copy program has already been loaded into the computer when you boot it up. At the A prompt, you should type copy space vacation dot doc, add a space, then the letter B for drive B and a colon, and then hit enter. Now notice you put a dot in between vacation and doc, even though only spaces show up on your screen when you view a directory of the files. That is the computer's way of putting in that particular space. Don't forget to put in that dot, or else you'll confuse the computer. Again, it's copy, space, vacation, dot, doc, and then a space, and then B, colon, and hit enter. The computer will find the file you've typed in on drive A, transfer it through the memory to drive B. But remember, this is an exact copy. You are not moving that file from one disk to another. Now you say, wait a minute, John. One problem here. I only have one disk drive. How can I copy to B? I've got a hard drive called C. I've got the A drive, but that's all. What do I do? I say, no problem. In a bit of computer logic here, your computer always assumes you've got a drive B, even if you don't. Now, this is actually a good piece of designing. In a OneDrive system, when you type copy space vacation dot doc space B colon, the machine will read the file into memory, and then finding no actual drive B will tell you to insert the disk for drive B into drive A. So you take out the original, you put into drive A the formatted empty disk, and you hit enter. The computer then copies it as if it were drive B. Now, before you smugly say to yourself, hey, who needs a second disk drive anyway? I'll spend the money for something else. Let me tell you about the infamous problems of disk swapping as it is known. Sooner or later, you're going to want to copy a file from A to your phony B drive that is too large to be copied all at once. The computer will then lead you through a series of swaps where it has you alternately putting in the original, then the copy, then the original, back and forth until it's done. This is a boring repetition that can cause you to make mistakes, which could mess up your original disk before you get a copy. Because of problems like this, the clever computer people came up with a system of what's known as write protection. That's WRITE. Your friendly word processor may use terms like load and save, but the computer literate person says instead that the computer reads from the disk and writes to the disk. So write protection prevents the computer from doing anything to the disk except reading from it. It's kind of like putting the original Declaration of Independence behind glass. You can see it, but you just can't touch. If you're using the larger floppy disks, you'll see a square notch cut into the right side of the disk. As long as that hole is open, the disk drive's electric eye can see through it, and the disk can be written or saved to. If you cover the notch with a light-proof sticker, usually black or silver, the drive will not see through the notch, and the computer will tell you that the disk is write-protected when you try to save or copy anything to it. Whenever you copy from one disk to another, and especially if it involves disk swapping, always write-protect the original by covering that notch. On the smaller plastic discs, the 3.5-inch ones, it's even easier. You'll see a small hole there on one side with a sliding cover. When the door is shut, you can write the disc. When the door is open, you cannot. I know it's the opposite of the way they do it with the floppy, and that's stupid, but I can't do anything about that. Some 3.5-inch disc labels even have little instructions printed on the backs to show you which way is write protected. Again, when a disc is write protected, you can still use it, but you cannot do anything to it that would change it. Some manufacturers will take the step of never even cutting or stamping the holes or notches to make sure the original is not tampered with. But this adds extra cost, so chances are you'll have to do it yourself to your original programs. By all means, do it. And if you haven't got the fancy little stickers, some black electrical tape works just fine. With your original disc write protected, you know that if the phone rings while you're copying files that require disc swaps and you lose track, the worst that will happen is that you'll have to start all over again. At least you will not have ruined a $100 program that you just bought. One thing you don't have to worry about is the copy not being as good as the original. The duplicate files or programs have not lost anything in the copying, because the copy process is digital. It's not like dubbing a videotape and having the copy look fuzzier. Once you make backups of your programs or your files, you can then put the originals away in a safe place and forget about them. Frequently, many commercial programs will give detailed instructions on the making of a backup right at the beginning of the instruction manual. In fact, some even include short programs right on the disc that will guide you through the process. Be advised, though, there are still a few companies that are afraid you're going to make illegal copies of a program and share them with friends. That's illegal, just as copying videos and music. Because of that illegal copying, some companies still use something called copy protection that makes a duplicate disc impossible to use, forcing you to use the original. There's a lot of debate about this in the software world, a lot of justification for promoting copyable discs, and also justification for ones that can't be copied. But just remember that if you wreck an important disc, and it's 8 p.m. on a Sunday night, and that disc was the original, well, there's not much you can do about it at that time. Make sure you know if you can back up or make a copy of your commercial software before you buy it. Pretty soon, you're going to want to make duplicates of a number of files on one disc, or perhaps all the files on one disc. There are two easy ways to do it. The first uses the copy command with something called wildcards, and the other way is with the DOS utility called Disk Copy that I touched on earlier. The slowest possible way for copying a series of files from one disk to another would be to simply use the copy command I just finished describing over and over again until the job was done. Using your monthly newsletter as an example, you could copy, space, January.txt, space, B colon, and then hit enter, and then copy, space, February.txt, space, B colon, and hit enter, and then March, and so on down the line until all the months were gone. All this typing can be automated to a great degree by using something called a wildcard. A wildcard in DOS is a term borrowed from card games, and I'm going to explain how it works. The DOS asterisk, when typed in instead of a file name, means, I don't care what the name is, just copy it. Using the monthly letters as an example, you would type copy, space, asterisk, dot, text, space, and then the B and the colon. That asterisk on your keyboard is what is called a wildcard when it's used in a DOS command. When you hit return, the computer would copy every file with the ending TXT regardless of the file name. That saves a lot of time. It also guarantees that no files with the TXT extension are overlooked. Let's say again that this same disk not only has January TXT, but also a picture on a file called January.pic, a PIC file. Same thing with all the other months as well. Each has its own PIC file. You want to copy both the text file for January and the PIC file for January. It's simple. Just use the wildcard instead of the extension. You do that by typing copy space January dot asterisk space B and a colon And now, any file with the name January will be copied regardless of what kind of file it is. If you want to copy every file over, you could type in two wildcards, that is, asterisk dot asterisk, and everything would be copied over. But the only trouble you'll get into doing that is you may ask the computer to copy more files than the receiving disk can hold, especially if it already has some files on it. Or you may copy some unneeded files in that kind of mass copy. As I mentioned before, there is a second easy way to copy all the files on a disk. It's a DOS utility called disk copy. That's one word, disk copy. You'll see it on your DOS disk. Because disk copy is not a part of CommandCom, you run it just like a separate program by typing its name. Disk copy is a lot different from the copy command because it makes an exact copy of the original by copying every part of the disk, even the blank spots. You don't need to make up a formatted blank disk when you use disk copy. Also, keep in mind that unlike the copy command, you cannot use disk copy to add files to ones already existing on your other disk. In the process of disk copying, it writes over everything on the receiving disk when it makes that exact duplicate. Some of the same procedures apply to disk copy as well as copy. You should write protect your original. If you have two drives and they are the same size, you can simply type in disk copy space A colon space B colon and then hit enter. Then follow the prompts on the screen and sit back and relax. If you only have one drive, you'll have to swap disks just as you did with copy, but please, again, write protect that original disk just in case. Some computers have one drive of one size, say a 5 1/4 inch floppy, and then a second 3 1/2 inch diskette. You cannot use disk copy A to B then, because the physical sizes of the disks are different. If you have that situation, you have to type in disk copy A colon, space, A colon, or in some cases, B colon, space, B colon, depending on what drive size you need. This will override the computer's tendency to try to copy to another disk drive. The computer will prompt you along the way to insert the source disk, that's the original, and later on, the target disk, which is the copy. Disk copy is a fast way to make backups of important software. The important thing to remember, though, is that the disk copy command is destructive to the receiving end. That means you cannot add files to existing files with disk copy. For that, you need the copy command I told you about earlier. Because disk copy makes an exact copy of the disk, it is possible to make a copy of your DOS disk, which includes some system files that you would not normally be able to transfer with the regular copy command. We'll be talking about making up a startup disk in a while, but if you want to duplicate your DOS disk with everything on it, disk copy is the command to use.